As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keane, along with Paul Sweeney. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Joining us now, as we just talked equities, we talked bonds now and yield. Stephen Major joins us, Global Head of Fixed Income Research at HSBC. Mr. Major appears with us because we will not discuss West Ham season. I mean, it's the only reason he would come on. Steve Major, you've been the bastion, Steve Major, of saying, yeah, yields are going to go higher, but then they're going to work their way back down. Is that trend in place yet, where yields are going to come down from the recent highs, and particularly the real yield recent high?
Yeah, I think we're seeing maybe the third or fourth peak in yields in the last couple of years. I mean, I've just written about this. It looks like a triple top. So any investor who bought in the last couple of years has been disappointed, unless they were lucky on their timing, really. So I just think back in January this year, people were reluctant to go into fixed income because of the strong rally we had from October through December. But now you've got a chance to go again. So those that missed out the last few months, they got a chance to buy. I would challenge the mainstream narrative that inflation is a problem, because I think the main explanation for the rising yields is actually down to growth. It's down to things that people didn't forecast, like population increases, fiscal largesse, that kind of thing. So I suspect the setup is quite fragile for growth going forward, and therefore there's potential for yields to fall quite a lot. I mean, if you want to look at it through the prism of what's priced in to the Fed rate outlook, as you know, only a few months ago we were all talking about six or seven cuts. Now it's gone down to one or two. That's just how the market works. The forward rate is not a forecast. It can move a long way away from the center of gravity. So I suspect the probability of rate hikes is much less than the probability of rate cuts. Therefore, there is an asymmetry in the setup. So if you enter 10-year treasuries today, if yields go up 100 basis points, you lose a couple of percent. If they go down 100 basis points, you make out big time. So I think that's what matters. You are now paid to go into fixed income.
So, Stephen, I guess the question for a lot of folks is, you know, how much duration do I take? I mean, we can park somebody in a 2-year treasury and get darn near 5% there. Is that the trade, or do I want to go out a little bit longer?
Well, yeah, 2-year is the safe trade. And I imagine some people, it depends who you are. So I can understand why a retail investor would extend from owning bills to twos right here. But there's also this idea that you need to take account of the opportunity cost. So the danger with owning twos is that you're going to regret it in 2 years' time when they mature. What you need is tens or longer. So I've been recommending people go into the belly. I think duration is a much underrated concept here. obviously, I'm wrong if equities keep going up every week, and I'm wrong if the Fed hikes again. But I'm just thinking about the balance of risks over the rest of the year. And I reckon yields go down.
Stephen, you're in Hong Kong, and you've got a real perception about the Pacific Rim. I'm going to start with a generalization that China's buying gold. Are they buying less of our bills, notes, and bonds?
Well, it's publicly available information. You can see the numbers for March that have just been released. So they have been reducing their holdings of dollar product. So that they might have less treasuries, but they might have more of something else. I think it's again publicly available information that the gold holdings have gone up in the private and public sector. What's interesting, though, is the entirety of the data. When you look at who owns the treasuries, about 30% are held overseas. And that number isn't going down. So for every foreign investor that's been reducing their holdings, there's someone else who's picking some bonds up. That has to be the case. So look at the European investors, for example. What Japan's doing is quite interesting, because perhaps the official sector could be selling some dollars soon, given the FX moves. But I think net-net, the overseas holdings are fairly steady, Tom.
Stephen, as I think about HSBC, I think complete global view. Where in the fixed income world do you see the best opportunities here? Is it the US or is it other parts of the world?
Well, I like emerging market sovereigns. And so we've been thinking about an interesting comparison between US high yield corporates and high yield emerging market sovereigns. Now, in that group, there'll be Egypt, Turkey, Oman, for example. But you can get dollar-denominated EM sovereigns with a really decent yield right now. So I think they compare quite nicely to corporate high yield. And I think globally, I would look at duration as being quite attractive in Europe as well as the US. In fact, the last three months, we've favored taking more duration exposure in Europe than the US. And that's because we think the ECB and or the Bank of England are going to cut before the Fed. But I think that's becoming a bit of a consensus view. It wasn't at the start of the year.
Right.
But it doesn't make it wrong. I think Europe cuts first.
Steve, just a minute left. What's a normal 10-year real yield in the United States? We're 2.8.
Well, it should reflect, it should reflect the trend GDP over time. So if you can get 2, you're above what the Fed has forecasted as longer run trend GDP. So you should be okay. If you want to compare the real yield to the longer run neutral rate or R star or what have you, I still think you've got enough yield in the, so the market yield is 150 to 200 above the Fed's R star. The market yield is above the trend GDP. So take your pick. There's enough yield there.
All right. Steve Major, thank you so much with HSBC.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
And it is something when you have to come in and fill very large shoes. Hans Gunther Rettiger was iconic at Morgan Stanley. He was such a voice, particularly with all the turmoil of Europe and Brexit and all that. And to come in and try to fix and replace Hans Gunther Rettiger is a tough task. James Lord joins us now, head of foreign exchange and emerging market strategy at Morgan Stanley. You have an advantage, James Lord. You have Robbie Feldman in Tokyo. Dovetail your foreign exchange work with truly the number one English-speaking expert on Japan, Dr. Feldman of MIT in Tokyo. Dovetail Robbie Feldman and you together on yen.
Well, I mean, you've just mentioned two of my heroes at Morgan Stanley, my former boss, Hans Rettiger, who was all over the dollar-yen trade when the Abenomics first started in 2013, and Robbie Feldman, who is just absolutely fantastic on all things Japan, obviously. I mean, I think what's happened really with the yen this morning is that there are, it looks as though the Ministry of Finance has intervened. We don't know for sure. There's been no official confirmation of it. But given the volatility that we saw on Friday and the move in dollar yen this morning, I mean, it certainly seems like the market conditions that they would intervene in. And yeah, we've seen a reasonable retracement since then.
Right.
I think the big question is whether it really works, right? I mean, I there's very little evidence that FX intervention by official authorities, whether central banks or ministries of finance, actually works. You kind of need to have a lot of the fundamentals lining up for it to really change. I just think that really in the case of dollar yen, the direction of it is going to be really more in the hands of Jay Powell rather than anyone in Japan.
Let me ask you just a general, unsophisticated question. I do best on those on Paul Monday. I'm really good at those. James Lord, if they spend out of their piggy bank to intervene, what is the cost? Is it a substantial cost to Japan to intervene or not?
Well, they have plenty of reserves that they can use to intervene in, and given the kind of the fairly sporadic way and or a relatively rare nature of these kind of interventions, I think dipping into their piggy bank every now and then for these sorts of events is not hugely costly in the overall context of their reserve position, but I guess like you have to sort of think about the benefit, right? Like what are they getting for the effort that they put in and the money that they spend doing it? And I'm not entirely sure that they get a huge amount. I mean, they can buy some time, right? The benefit is that they get some time where the market starts to stabilize temporarily, starts to reassess. Maybe people who are long dollar yen kind of just nurse their injuries for a little bit. But I don't think the benefit is really there for the long term.
Tip to tip on intervention. And I'm going to be careful here, folks. Yep. Bloomberg does not report that there was an intervention by institutions in Japan. Mr. Lord has made clear that's their interpretation of Morgan Stanley. I want to be very careful on that. Paul, the yen strength tip to tip on this right now is about 3.5%.
Okay,
that's the ginormous move. That's like a normal day in the, you know, name the Polish zloty or whatever.
Exactly. James, why doesn't, just for those of us who don't follow this day to day, why wouldn't the central bank come out and say that what they did or did not do, number one? Number two, if they're out there buying yen, aren't they calling your trader at Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs saying, buy yen for me? Wouldn't you guys know? How does that all work?
Well, I think they would go mostly by the local banks. And by local banks, I mean not the representatives of foreign banks that are working in Japan. I think mostly that would be done by the Japanese banks. At least that's the kind of history and the market color that we get when these sorts of events happen. And eventually, you know, they will confirm it. I mean, I think at the end of the month, at the end of May, they'll report the official intervention data. That gets reported on a monthly basis, and in there we will see whether or not they've intervened. And I think, you know, maybe that kind of strategic ambiguity in the short term is helpful for them, because if they come out and say, actually, no, we didn't intervene now, then, you know, I think a lot of investors would see that as a green light to start buying some dollars again, and they clearly don't really want to do that. And if they confirmed it now, then it would just result in a lot more questions about how much, and is this going to be a new policy? And so I think for the time being, they'll just let the market keep guessing and just wait for that official confirmation to come out at the end of May.
All right, James. So if I look at the Bloomberg Dollar Spot Index, up about 4% really off of that kind of late December mark here. If the dollar's that strong, who's on the other side of that train? What currencies are getting hurt the most?
Well, I mean, yen has been on the other side of it, clearly, for a lot of this year. And a lot of the low-yielding currencies really have been the ones that have suffered the most, right? I mean, we've been in an environment this year where at least up until the end of Q1, we saw appetite for carry trades were very, very strong, right? And we include the dollar in that. I mean, as the highest-yielding G10 currency, it was performing extremely well against everything else that was pretty much lower yielding than it. So euros obviously suffered a bit this year. Cables started to come under a little bit of pressure. But then as we've started to see more and more evidence of this in reinflation in the United States, it has started to impact rates volatility, and it has started to impact FX volatility. And when that happens, carry trades come under pressure. So even the likes of Mexican peso, Brazilian real, they've started to weaken a little bit more meaningfully recently. So the dollar strength has really broadened out from what was just a low yielder trade to something that's been a little bit broader.
Where are we on dollar strength? I haven't asked this question in ages, but on like trade-weighted broad, trade-weighted major, real trade-weighted dollar, I'll let you pick the series, but how richly priced is U.S. dollar right now?
Good.
Yeah, I mean, we're at kind of close to multi-decade highs, really, in the real. If you take the Fed's trade-weighted real dollar index on a real basis, we're pretty much at multi-decade highs. I mean, we haven't quite, I don't think, in real terms, gone back to the level that we saw around October 2022, which incidentally was the last time the Ministry of Finance in Japan intervened. Like, that was coming off of a long bear market for US treasuries. Rate hikes have been priced in quite substantially, and we haven't quite got to that level on the broad dollar. I mean, this was when euro dollar was kind of trading closer to parity,
right.
And we had a lot more dollar strength. We haven't got back to those levels just yet, but yeah, I mean, it's interesting that was the last, the Ministry of Finance intervention in 2022, well, in October 2022, did mark the peak of the dollar. I'm not sure it will be this time, because I think we really need to see U.S. inflation come down, but the parallel is there.
James, I'm running out of time. Let me squeeze this in. President Trump and his supporters over the weekend talk about managing the dollar. Can any given politician or government manage the dollar?
I think it's going to be really tough. I think it's really tough to do that. I mean, I think on the one hand, coordinated FX intervention can work. Obviously, the most famous example of that being the Plaza Accord. So if the US were able to convince as many trading partners to cooperate, then that might work. But if it's just the US pushing for it itself, I'm not sure that it's going to be that effective, particularly if it's not,
right,
again, consistent with the outlook for the U.S. economy. If you continuously get strong inflation prints, and clearly if you have a weaker dollar, the risk is that, right, inflation just stays high in the U.S. for longer, and the Fed just keeps hiking, then it will really blunt the impact of it.
Very informative. Don't be a stranger. He's nicer than Hans Redeker.
Well,
now, Hans was sort of always surly.
They're all nice.
James Lord, thank you so much, with Morgan Stanley. It's been too long. Tina Fordham joins us right now with Fordham Global Foresight. She's got some incredible perspective on geopolitics. And Tina, I really want to focus on what I haven't focused on, which is to go narrow on Gaza. I saw a photograph over the weekend of the complete total Syria-like devastation of Gaza. What are they going to do down the strip in Rafah? And how does diplomacy fit in to a further devastation of Israel of the geography?
Well, you've laid out just how complex and depressing the picture is. There's no other word for it. We are hearing that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is on the verge of issuing arrest warrants to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, There are talks going on with Mohammed bin Salman and other officials in Riyadh on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum meeting there. And I guess it was Friday that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, said that they were prepared to begin the offensive in Rafah unless Hamas returns the hostages and agrees to a peace deal.
Paul wants to get in here, but I gotta ask a dumb question. If I'm in northern Gaza and they blow me out, I go down to middle Gaza. If I'm in middle Gaza and they blow me out, I go down to lower Gaza. Gaza's on the border with Egypt. If they blow people out of Rafah, where do they go?
Well, and this is why the talks are going on with the Egyptians right now, who have not accepted Palestinian refugees, right? And a corollary to this, which I think people forget, is that during the war in Syria, Turkey accepted large numbers of refugees from that war. A similar agreement has not been forthcoming with Egypt. They don't want to get stuck with a lot of refugees, and they have their own security concerns to be mindful of. But yes, there's nowhere for the refugees to go. There's nowhere for the people of Gaza to go. And Israelis are ramping up the pressure. And we have to wonder if what's going on the sidelines of these meetings in Riyadh is that the Gulf Arab states are doing exactly the same thing.
So, Tina, we're more than 6 months into this operation here by the Israelis, you know, unspeakable levels of destruction of Gaza. In hindsight, is there any indication that Hamas miscalculated here terribly in their October 7th attack?
Well, it's hard to see what they've gained apart from putting the Palestinians back on the agenda. Remember that, you know, just a few, well, 6 months ago, really, people were talking about this impending deal normalization between Israel and Saudi and others that would have paved the way for a lot of regional economic integration. Gulf states still want that to happen, but a Palestinian state was not part of the discussion. And then, you know, we've entered this kind of hellscape of the offensive in Gaza, the Houthi rebels, the recent exchange, you know, kind of unprecedented exchange of missile fire. My question, I mean, to myself, is this the geopolitical bottom? Like, can it get worse? Or right. is Hamas decided that it's going to accept Oslo kind of terms? I mean, that is kind of mind-blowing, but you really have to get to the bottom before you can consider.
Tina, I think you're the most qualified person I know, maybe Leslie Vinge-Maria Chatham House as well, but Tina Fordham, you are more qualified than anyone I know to talk about the college protests in America, wrapped over to 1968, and all the work I've done on that with Guy Sarmon of Paris and others. Yeah. How do you treat the protests in elite schools in America within the filter that you have of diplomacy and the history of protest?
It is quite a spectacle. I mean, first of all, I'm a Columbia alum and I'm on the advisory board for SIPA, the School of International and Public Affairs, which is also caught up in these, although it's mainly the college. I don't think this is 1968, right? I think that this is identity politics in the United States that has now incorporated a foreign policy angle. I think it's incredibly difficult for the university administrations to, you know, to balance their commitment to free speech and to the community that is a university with their Title VI obligations. They've got to protect students. And the whole sorry spectacle seems to me, and you know, I sit in London, where I have for a long time, to be a culmination of the culture wars and in some ways the TikTokification of very complex issues.
So, Tina, I guess, again, we're 6 months into this. Is there any consensus with the people that you talk to that really have informed opinions and analysis of the situation? Is there a scenario where Israel can end this war in any reasonable time frame?
There are off-ramps available. There are definitely scenarios where Israel can end this war. What is less clear is whether Netanyahu can end the war, because his political future is so wrapped up in the continuation of the conflict. As soon as the conflict ends, he's no longer a wartime prime minister, and new elections will be called. He was unpopular before. Remember those massive protests in the cities, and the failure to bring the hostages home, and the failure indeed to protect Israel against the Hamas attack, has made him even less popular. So he doesn't want to face elections. And, you know, this is a very tactical, I think, response that we see now. I think Netanyahu is going day to day.
Tina, thank you. Brilliant. Tina Fordham, Fordham Global Insight. Thank you so much there on the narrowness of Gaza.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Your daily look at the front pages around the world, out on YouTube. Use those hearts like you used for Lisa. Give John Tucker some love.
This one comes from the Post, and I am shocked by this story. The Post cites a report by financial tech company Self. It says New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut rank among the top five states for residents paying the most in federal and state taxes on their lifetime earnings. Yes, we have the unenviable distinction of being number one in the Garden State, leading the bank-breaking pack. Residents shell out a staggering $987,172 on average for various taxes during their lifetime. So that's roughly 54.3% of a resident's total lifetime earnings. And
but we get a bang for the buck for that, though, don't we?
Oh, yeah. And this doesn't include my tolls or the advancement of the MTA's June 30th
Eric, target this is different than when Lisa does it.
I'm just saying.
John's dealing with Dr. Paul here.
West Virginians can sit pretty well. They have to fork over the lowest amount of total taxes nationwide.
But it's affecting migration nationally. You see it, Illinois. Yeah. In some of these other big states.
Well, when you retire, do you stay here and still, fork over gigantic taxes or whatever? Anyway.
I'm never going to retire, so, it works out.
The next one has me crying in my beer. This comes from the Financial Times, citing a study by Deloitte. Britons are choosing to spend less money in bars and pubs than at any time since the lockdown ended. This survey asked about 3,200 UK customers if they had spent more, less, or the same on leisure the past 3 months. It showed sentiment in eating out and drinking in pubs and bars had declined by about 6 percentage points. They didn't talk to anybody I know. Apparently, it's just getting too expensive, though.
Yeah.
For example, they cite Tim Martin. He's the founder of J.D. Weatherspoon, the chain there. He said competition from supermarkets is a pretty big challenge for a lot of the pubs. you buy your beer in the supermarket.
That's original thought.
Well, yeah, it's cheaper, and you just sit home in front of the telly and.
All right, so John, I'm at a beach bar in Belmar yesterday.
Right.
Nice sunny day. Going to go get a cold beer out there, sit out on the patio, watch some boats. Miller Lite draft, $14 at the Jersey Shore.
For one draft
beer? Exactly.
What?
Exactly.
John, you buy a case for that.
I know. I said one.
No,
the control room is transfixed by this. They're just,
that's like,
they got signs up. Bring back Lisa.
Anyway, all right. Let's do the Stones. They kicked off the latest tour last night at Houston's Energy Stadium. That's appropriate. AP describes Mick Jagger often strutting up and down the stage with seemingly boundless energy, while Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood played many familiar guitar riffs beloved by fans. And Jagger led the audience in sing-alongs. Drummer Charlie Watts, he wasn't there. That's because he's dead. Houston was the first
nice.
Stop on the band's 16-city tour. During the 18-song concert set list, the Stones played several tracks off their new record. The Stones have been touring for more than 60 right. years, and Mick, 80 years old, along with Keith.
Paul, you're the expert on how many times 80. Have you seen the Stones?
I've seen them three, and I wish I would have seen them like 10 times. More. But
I mean, do they do most of the performing, the music, or is it like the backup?
Oh no,
no. I think no, I mean the, every no. song Keith starts with a world famous riff, you know, and then but so it's extraordinary. But I can't wait to see what they're charging for tickets and all that kind of stuff. And another thing. Luke, one of the Luke's, the country singer, put in like 90,000 fans at Beaver Stadium at Penn State over the weekend. Country music's huge too.
It is.
So yeah. So
well, most appropriately for the Stones, they were sponsored in part by AARP.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
You're serious? They're
that's sponsored. Serious.
Well, I mean, these guys, they go on tour and they sell out these stadiums. They don't. It's just extraordinary.
I think they had to be in bed by like 8 o'clock.
When is Lisa?
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.